mean that conservatives cannot be funny. There are great conservative comics, from P.J. O'Rourke to Jeff Foxworthy to Nick DiPaolo. But the observed phenomenon of humor being used as a political tool does skew. And we see that there are neurological, sociological, and philosophical grounds that explain this. Of course, there are some political jokes that cut across partisan lines. Consider Congress. I mean, there's a political joke right there.
Lecture 24, Ridiculousness and the Human Condition.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Jim.
How's it going? Last lecture, huh?
Last one.
Must be excited.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what's this one about?
Humor and the meaning of life.
Meaning of life. Oh, you know, I've got one for that. So this guy goes to his doctor and he says, "Doctor, do you think I'm going to live to be 100? His doctor sits back and he goes, "Well, you know, you look pretty good." He goes, "Do you drink?" "Nope." "Do you smoke?" "Absolutely not." Doctor says, "Do you eat fried foods?" And the guy is like, "Doc, I eat nothing but raw vegetables. Carrots, kale, cucumbers, peas, nothing but veggies." The doctor's like, "Well, do you gamble? Do you drive fast cars? Do you fool around?" And the guy's like, "Nope, nope, nope, none of that." And the doctor stops and he goes, "Why exactly do you want to live a long life?"
I'm gonna miss you guys.
Well, consider this our hearty farewell.
Thank you, my friend. In this series, we've examined types of humor, humor theory, and humor ethics. All of these together give us a sense of the universal phenomenon that is humor. Our last question is how these work together to allow people to live the good life. A couple lectures ago, we asked whether humor was a necessary part of being human. We saw different answers. Here we'll ask a similar but slightly different question. We will assume that humor is not necessary, that we could live without humor. But we will now ask in what ways the inclusion of humor leads to human flourishing. How is human life improved by humor? And are those who are humorous living an impoverished life? Is laughter the best medicine? Is laughter medicine at all? Surely this old saying is meant metaphorically. Now, a life chock full of merriment will lift the spirits and make for a happier lived experience. But can we take this aphorism literally? Does humor aid in health? Does humor aid in wellness? Can we think of humor as medication to allow us to live our fullest lives as biological beings? Perhaps the most obvious place to start such a discussion is with one of the most popular books on the effects of humor, Norman Cousins' Anatomy of an Illness as Perceived by the Patient. The caricature of this book is that Cousins claims to have cured himself of a life-threatening illness by watching Marx Brothers movies. The reality, of course, is more complicated. Following a trip to the Soviet Union as a cultural ambassador in the 1960s, Cousins returned home with a serious medical condition. Specialists couldn't identify the malady as it worsened and worsened until he was eventually diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis, which is an illness that causes the connective tissue in the body to disintegrate. Cousins' specialists gave him only a 1 in 500 chance of beating the ailment, and so he decided to work with his doctor to change the approach to his treatment. This approach was not a substituting of laughter for medicine, but to change a number of the elements of his treatment. First, he altered the drug regimen. Because the condition was extremely painful, Cousins was prescribed a variety of powerful painkillers. He decided to move away from them because he thought it possible that the side effects of these painkillers, which were not helping the condition itself, might in fact be contributing to the worsening of the condition. He then added other medications, especially megadoses of vitamin C, which, based on the best research of the times, held promise for aiding in the fight against the disease. finally, he did use comedy as a drug. The reasoning being that his particular ailment may have been caused by problems with his adrenal glands. The adrenal system is sensitive to stress in the human body. When we're under stress, the adrenal system does not work as well, leaving us more susceptible to all sorts of illnesses. Cousin's work as an ambassador put him under severe stress that was not experienced by his wife, who accompanied him, but who had fewer obligations. He wondered whether the differential in stress might explain why the same exposure to polluted Russian air, full of heavy metals from manufacturing plants not under the restrictions of environmental laws, would cause him, but not his wife, to have had the physiological reaction he was experiencing. He considered the possibility that the reaction could work in both directions. If stress causes change in hormones and other aspects of the bodies which can lead to illness, could the opposite of stress, joy, mirth, hope, and love, also affect the body, but do so in a way that was protective or even curative? Could he help the body heal itself by giving it a better psychological environment in which to work? His first step was to change his physical environment. Hospitals, he argues, are the worst place for sick people. The constant interruptions to sleep, the lousy food, the uncomfortable surroundings all lead to stress, not the relaxation that would put the body in its best place to heal itself. Even though hospitals are created to maximize the effectiveness of the medical aid they deliver, he considered that the structure designed to help was actually harming. So he moved to a hotel room, a very nice hotel room. There, he would watch episodes of Candid Camera and Marx Brothers movies and have his nurses read funny stories aloud to him. He found that good, full belly laughs did have a physiological effect. Laughing heartily decreased his pain and allowed him to sleep for a couple hours, a stretch of time his pain had not allowed previously. A lack of sleep is itself a stressor, so increased sleep meant less to heal and more time when the body could focus on healing. As his pain decreased, his mood improved, and his sleeping time increased. This then led to markers in his blood becoming better and better, all of which led to less stress and more humor. It was a virtuous cycle that continued allowing him to get better and better until he was largely pain-free and able to return to something like his old life. Cousins doesn't claim that he was cured by Groucho Marx's Dr. Hugo Z. Hackenbush, but he does argue that he found that humor allowed his body to work better and helped it heal itself. The humor was not, strictly speaking, medicine, but it did create the personal and physiological context in which the body could use its immunity and healing responses in a more effective way. The human body thrives on humor. Our question is whether humor is a part of the good life. Human life may be thought to have three elements, body, mind, and spirit. On this model, Cousins is contending that from the purely bodily perspective, the state of mind is incredibly powerful and plays a crucial role in physical health. Humor is not medicine, but could perhaps be thought of as nutrition, in that regular doses allow the body to function at a higher level of efficiency and leads to improved health and a more fulfilling life. So, Cousin contends, insofar as human life is bodily, humor is a part of the well-lived life. But let's move from the body to the mind. We saw in our discussion of play theory that Aristotle thought that acting in an extreme fashion was a vice, but acting moderately is a virtue. When it comes to humor, he says, one should neither be a bore with no sense of humor, nor a buffoon who's always kidding around. Rather, one should be witty with an appropriate sense of humor. Similarly, Freud, as we saw in our discussion of relief theory, argued that humor plays an essential role in helping maintain a functioning mind. Jokes, Freud argued, are essential to relieve the pressure that builds up within the mind because of the constant struggle between the id and superego. This tension left unchecked could fracture the mind and cause neurotic behaviors. But humor acts as a safety valve, allowing the tension to be relieved to exit the body as laughter. But we no longer buy the Aristotelian or Freudian picture of the mind. From the contemporary viewpoint of psychology, is humor a necessary part of the well-lived life? Let's adopt a more contemporary neuroscientific approach to the human mind and see if humor is needed for psychological health, given how we now know the brain to function. We know that some brains, which are not working well, do not appreciate humor, even if it's fully recognized. Those who suffer from depression, for example, will understand that an utterance is a joke. They'll get the joke, but still will find no humor in it. Depressed minds just do not experience the joy of mirth that accompanies humor. The fact that so many great comedians have suffered from depression shows us that depression does not damage our ability to see humor, to get humor, to understand humor. It only affects our ability to be affected by humor. Depression affects the brains in a number of ways, but one of them is to disrupt the reward systems. The depressed brain does not reward itself for positive acts the way a non-depressed brain does. We know that the pathways associated with humor involve the reward systems in addition to other areas used in cognition. So, the depressed person still has the cognitive capacity to get the joke, but the brain's reward system will not release the chemical happy juice that usually accompanies it. Some antidepressant medications work to artificially stabilize the amount of neurochemicals associated with the reward system. As such, the person taking the medication no longer feels down in the dumps. But the regimentation of the neurochemical reward also means that it will not be released in the usual amounts when they get a joke. Some antidepressants will still keep the treated depressed mind from reacting as usual to humor. On the other hand, there are ailments that can lead the brain in the other direction, hyperhumor. There are psychological conditions that lead to uncontrollable laughter and seeing humor everywhere. In 1962, in Kinshasa, Tanzania, an outbreak of contagious, uncontrollable laughter broke out. Starting at a boarding school for girls, some of the students started laughing and couldn't stop. Others who heard them likewise began to laugh uncontrollably. Ultimately, more than 1,000 people experienced this over an 18-month period in the region. Entire villages would become virtually paralyzed because so large a percentage of the population was seized with the uncontrollable urge to laugh. We know that laughter is a contagious psychological state. When I performed at a comedy club in Washington, D.C. once, the owner of the club made all the comedians sit in the front row until the rest of the club filled. He then signaled us to vacate, forcing the new customers into the front. People are reticent to sit in the front row out of fear of being targeted by the comedians, but the owner explained that the proximity makes for easier laughs. And once someone started laughing, everyone would start. It's a well-documented psychological effect. What was witnessed in Tanzania is an extreme example of this phenomenon. The explanation of the outbreak of contagious laughter is not medical. It wasn't a virus or a disease. Rather, experts argue it was the result of cultural stress. Life in these villages was hard. And when the release of laughter began, it spread out of psychological need and became seemingly unstoppable. So, in one direction, issues with the brain can lead to too little appreciation of humor. On the other, issues with the brain can lead to too much. So, we cannot attribute the standard reaction to humor as either necessary or sufficient for brain health. But, is there a relationship at all? Does the healthy brain prefer humor? Or, alternatively, does humor help maintain a healthy brain? The answer is both. Let us look at the second question first. Does the healthy brain prefer humor? The loss of one's sense of humor in older individuals is a symptom of the onset of Alzheimer's disease. As the brain ceases to work properly, one of the first obvious behavioral signs is that the person stops finding funny things funny. A healthy brain does indeed seek out humor. There's evidence supporting an affirmative answer to the second question as well. In a number of ways, humor helps the healthy brain stay healthy. We know that humor decreases stress hormones, and this has the sort of effects that we talked about in the Norman Cousins case. But increasingly, it's coming to be seen that humor has cognitive benefits. Humor makes the brain work better. Studies are now indicating that humor helps in the learning process. If you hear a joke before having to undertake a novel task, the joke will prime the brain to acquire new knowledge better. It's not clear whether this is because a relaxed brain is simply more open, or if the engagement of the higher executive functions needed to get a joke are also the parts of the brain that will be needed to construct a scaffolding of concepts and skills internalized in the mind through the learning process. But whichever it is, it's clear that having a good laugh before you start a new task will improve your cognitive ability to learn. You will be better at making new connections, better at acquiring new skills, better at assimilating new ways of doing things if you laugh first. Beyond the individual brain, social psychology also shows positive effects of humor. In my lecture on the science of laughter, I mentioned the work of Robert Provine, who shows that humor is what he calls a social lubricant. When people laugh together, it greases the skids for their interpersonal relationship and leads to better relations. When we laugh, we send a social signal that we are open. And social psychologists have demonstrated what philosopher Ted Cohen calls joke intimacy. That is, when we laugh together, there's a residue of friendliness. So, humor aids in the individual and in the social mind. So, that's why we need to have humor as an element of the well-lived life from the perspective of the body and the mind. But what about the soul? Now, I'm not going to speculate here on any sort of metaphysical claim about the existence or nature of God, of the human soul, whether it passes judgment upon death, right? Any of that. I mean soul more colloquially, in a way that even an atheist could buy into. It's the spirit, the stance one adopts towards existence, how one chooses to be in life. Is humor a necessary part of how we need to be towards life? Philosopher Lydia Amir argues that it is, and supports this claim with a combination of a de-Christianized version of the views of Soren Kierkegaard combined with elements found in the philosopher Martin Heidegger. Recall that for Kierkegaard, there was a stepwise process the human being must proceed through in order to come to understand God. God, for Kierkegaard, is beyond human reason, and therefore all religion must be irrational in order to have a mind well suited to the task of appropriately embracing the irrational. One must train it through the appreciation of irony and humor. It's only the mind that can revel in irony and can fully grasp the humorous that will be flexible and strong enough in the appropriate way to be ready to receive the wisdom of being truly religious. Now, for Heidegger, the situation is a bit different. To him, the central question of philosophy is what it is to be. He follows his teacher, Edmund Husserl, in reorienting the process of philosophy away from abstractions. Plato famously argued that the key to knowledge is using the eye of the mind to gaze upon eternally unchanging forms that inhabited a world of their own. The real world is not the world of experience, but the world of these perfect ideas, the forms. Plato argued that the philosopher must turn away from the world of the changing, of the perishable, of the imperfect material objects around us. Instead, the philosopher must enter a mental realm of absolute concepts and come to know them, including the concept of the good. Then and only then can the philosopher find the wisdom he seeks. Husserl argues that this was a flawed starting point. We must take as the basic data, as the foundational facts of philosophy, internal human experience, the lived life. We do not use the eye of the mind to gaze out upon an external world. We live within our own mind. Everything I see is a vision in my mind. Everything I hear is a sound in my mind. Everything I experience or think is contained within my mind. I am my mind and the internal experiences it has. That's all. I may be able to conceptualize them, understand which are the essential elements that define certain sorts of experiences and which are unimportant accidental elements. But if I am to have knowledge of anything, it's of my own experienced life. Heidegger follows this approach and argues that the fundamental question is, what is it to be the experiencing self? He argues that we may ask this question and think we know, but there's a central contradiction we must face. One must see that one is not what one is, but what one hopes to be. We live not by being, but by projecting. We are what we are not. By that, he means we're projects. Everything we choose because it helps us become the being we're trying to be. We don't look in the mirror when we ask ourselves who we are. We look into the future. I'm the person who will go to Florida on vacation. I'll be the person who will have saved $1 million for retirement. I'm the person who will have watched all the Marx Brothers movies 100 times. I'm not the person I am, but the person I am trying to be. The person I'm not yet. We're projects assembling ourselves through actions we choose for our present unrealized selves. We are who we are not yet, but choose to hopefully be. But we can't really be who we are until we have the sudden, shocking realization that we will die. It's only when we realize that our time is finite that we realize we can't be everything. We can only be a few things. We have to choose. We're limited in our future, but our future is ourselves. So we're limited and must choose what we will be, not knowing if we'll even have enough time to be it. That, Heidegger asserts, is the foundational contradiction of existence. We are what we are not, and we may not even have the time to be that. Given that fact, we must choose how to be. Lydia Amir takes a similar pessimistic stance towards human existence. Like Heidegger, she sees a foundational contradiction at the heart of the human condition. Humans are, by nature, aspirational beings. We always have dreams, hopes, desires, and plans. We are our plans. But we live in a fickle world that often bars the way to the realization of those plans. Nothing ever really works out completely. The best laid plans of mice and men are often crushed by a cruel and indifferent reality. We live lives that are filled with irresolvable metaphysical, ethical, and religious conflicts. We want certainty from a universe that will never provide it. We want to do the right thing and to be happy when we can never really figure out what the right thing is and can never really figure out how to be fully happy. The human condition is to necessarily want what we absolutely cannot have. This means that human life is unavoidably tragic. We could give in to the tragedy. We could simply give up, surrender to the universe. Facing this exact concern, Albert Camus contended that the central question in all of philosophy is, why not commit suicide? If life is pointless and meaningless, why bother living it? If the universe is an uncaring place, who cares about living? We are, Camus contended, like the Greek hero Sisyphus. Sisyphus angered the gods and as a punishment was forced to roll a tremendous boulder up a hill for all eternity. Just as he got it near the top, it would roll over him and go back to the bottom, forcing him to start all over again. An eternity of pointless pain and labor, that, Camus said, is what the human condition is. Cheery, huh? Camus says that his real interest in Sisyphus is not the toil of rolling the rock, but the moment after it returned to the bottom of the hill. Sisyphus is forced to stand up, look down at the boulder, and take his first step down the hill, knowing full well the pain and strain that was about to come, and the futility of it all. And yet, he takes that step. Camus argues that while Sisyphus is bound by the punishment of the gods, he can, at that moment, be free. His freedom comes from an act of mind, from choosing to go down to roll the rock. If he decides that this is what he wants to do, then he can't be punished by it. As an act of scorn against the gods, Camus says, Sisyphus chooses to do something he knows is meaningless. Such a choice would be absurd. But life is absurd. And in that absurdity, he himself becomes both absurd and free through his act of scorn. Amir takes a similar line, arguing that in the face of rational hopelessness, we come to grasp that hopelessness. Yet, we as humans continue to hope. To hope when you know most hopes are dashed is to be ridiculous. And so, human beings are, Amir argues, ridiculous beings. Amir's notion of humans as ridiculous is like Camus' claim that we're absurd, but importantly different. Camus' absurd being gains humanity through an act of scorn. Amir's ridiculous being gains humanity through an act of humor. We have to laugh at ourselves. The necessary search for meaning in a meaningless universe makes us ridiculous, and we must embrace the ridicule to which we're subject and laugh at it. We have to get the cosmic joke that's being played on us. We see the contradiction in the human condition, and instead of allowing it to drive us into defeat, we embrace it and laugh at it. The key to being human is, in her words, transmuting suffering into joy through the use of humor. Like Kierkegaard, Amir sees the power of humor to enrich and alter the human mind. The mind that can appreciate incongruity, that can create mirth from logical conflict, that can delight in the full understanding of the irresolvable. The alchemy of humor reveals itself as redemptive, she says. We're meaningless beings who gain a meaning by being able to laugh at ourselves and our meaningless search for meaning. We are fully human, Amir argues, because we can find humor in being human. We're like Nelson from The Simpsons, pointing at ourselves in the mirror and saying, ha-ha! So, throughout these lectures, we've looked at types of humor, at various attempts to formulate a theory that allows us to set out the necessary and sufficient conditions for an act to be humorous, and the ethical questions that surround who can tell what jokes when. In none of these endeavors did we actually come up with a final answer. We worked hard, thought in very different ways, sought answers from natural and social science as well as the history of ideas. But we leave with none of these questions decisively concluded. And yet, hopefully, we're happy. We have been, as Amir would have us, ridiculous in seeking that which we could not find. Philosophy is that curious endeavor that seeks answers to questions that may never be answered. Still, the process has left us with insights about humor. We now understand the notion in a deeper way and have a fuller appreciation of it. We've made a joke out of jokes. Instead of killing humor, like the frog in E.B. White's famous analogy, analyzing it has allowed us to engage in meta-humor, appreciating the ridiculousness of ridiculousness. And hopefully, we find that funny. If so, we are truly ridiculous, which is, Amir argues, the real meaning of life. So, the next time someone asks you what the meaning of life is, just tell them the one about the human who walks into a bar. So, this human walks into a bar. The bartender looks up and says, "Hey, did you hear the one about the human who walked into a bar?" The human says, "No." And the bartender says, "So, this human walks into a bar. The bartender looks up and says, "Did you ever hear the one about the human who walked into a bar?" The human says, "No." And the bartender says, "So, this human walks into a bar." The bartender looks up and says, "Did you..." Ridiculous.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.